Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode, I'll be joined by Andy Phillip and Rachel Avery to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read to you by Alex Watson.
The Scottish and UK governments have restated their commitment to work together on welfare policy in response to a report by MPs. As part of the Scotland Act 2016, welfare policies will be fully devolved north of the border, but various issues, including the pandemic, have slowed progress. A report from the Scottish Affairs Committee called on both governments to publicly state their commitment to cooperate in the delivery of benefits in Scotland. In response to the report, both have stated their commitment to work together. A meeting of the British-Irish Council will take place in Wales on Friday. The meeting of politicians from across the UK and Ireland comes amid ongoing negotiations between London and Brussels about post-Brexit trading arrangements in Northern Ireland. The Northern Ireland Protocol is likely to be discussed at the meeting in Cardiff. Earlier this week, Brexit Minister Lord Frost was urged by political parties at Stormont to find agreement with the EU over the protocol. Austrian Chancellor Alexander Schallenberg said that the country will go into a national lockdown to contain a fourth wave of coronavirus cases. Mr. Schallenberg said the lockdown will start on Monday and initially last for 10 days. Most stores will close and cultural events will be cancelled. He initially said all students would have to go back into home schooling.
Thanks, Alex. Right, let's turn our attention to this week, the week that has been another doozy in Scottish politics. We have had a delay to the deposit return scheme. We have had arguments over conversion therapy. And, of course, the Westminster second job fallout claims yet more victims. Let's begin with the delay to the deposit return scheme, because this seems like yet another thing that's been in the Holyrood pipeline for some time, which has been kicked, the can, for want of a better pun, has been kicked further down the road. Andy, can you explain to us briefly what the deposit return scheme would have meant had it come into effect this year as it was planned?
Yeah, this has been in the running for years now, and it got a bit snarled up with various industry problems. The practicalities seemed a little bit more tricky than the concept, but nevertheless, you know, this shouldn't be like reinventing the wheel, and a lot of people make that point very clear. I mean, it's not like recycling is an entirely new thing. The previously announced start date was July next year, and it's pretty much been a bit of a shambolic delay all round, I think. More embarrassing because, of course, the Greens are now in the Scottish government, and this was a big thing for them, quite rightly. Yet again, the reality of now being in government has kind of come home, and they've had to sort of, I don't know, quietly accept that this is now going to have to be delayed. But of course, their opponents were very quick to round on them for having to roll back on something now that they're in government with the SNP.
And Rachel, you might be too young to remember this. I just about remember returning bottles to shops. You got a little 10p or 20p. It was usually bars, iron
brew. No, I do remember.
Bottles and other things like that.
Too you would young.
Do you remember?
How old are you? Like 10?
I didn't look really old. It didn't exist for a long time. Or hasn't existed for some time, I should say. But, you know, it's like Andy says, it's not entirely a new concept. And, of course, they do it in Germany and France, don't they?
Yes, this has been something that we've done before. And it is something that it sounds relatively simple to do. So I think a lot of people will be frustrated at it being delayed a bit longer. Two of the reasons they have said it's being delayed is Brexit and the pandemic. And I'm sure you've heard from the last few weeks, a lot of things have been blamed on Brexit and the pandemic. I think people are getting a little sick and tired of hearing that as being the excuse for things not going the way they're meant to be at the moment.
I mean, considering it was something that was in the pipeline pre-Brexit.
Yeah, I think this was agreed in 2019, was it not? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was confirmed in 2017.
17.
I think that's when Nicola Sturgeon said it was going to be. And the idea was 20 pence for your cans and bottles, and the money comes back when you return them for recycling. There were problems, I think, with bars and pubs and bars and places like that were saying, well, what do we do with all of this? Where do we store stuff for recycling? Where do we store the things for... There was problems about, is it going to be more glass? Is it going to be more plastic? How is it going to work in practice? And that kind of made it bump back a little bit, and then everything just snowballed from there, I think.
Because I know a lot of industry, people use a lot of glass and bottles in the beer industry. And like you said, the hospitality industry, who seem to have just had a bit of a naff time of it as of late. Anyway, they had raised their concerns. You know, small shops where you were returning the bottles and the cans to, where were they going to store them? And it seemed like things like that hadn't really been thought through very well. I know British Glass had an issue as well when it came to the idea of using the glass for recycling. A lot of concerns were raised. But again, on the environmental front, you had a lot of campaigners. I know that our paper spoke to this week a number of people who do litter clear-ups, for example, down on our wonderful beaches that we have along the East Coast. And they said that they've been let down again. Andy, it does feel like another one of these Scottish Government initiatives that A, has been thought through in the first place quite to the extent of that you would hope, and B, just seems to be a bit of a pipe dream.
Yeah, and that's always the problem about looking in retrospect that maybe, you know, this was about the PR and the headline rather than the, you know, and then work out the details later. And that's a real shame, because quite clearly a lot of thought and campaigning from outside interests had been put into this. And I mean, I remember when it was announced, it was eye-catching. It was a big policy and it was a real statement of an intent. So for something like that to get knocked back and then knocked back, and then for the politics to kind of overtake it and it becoming a stick for the opposition to, you know, to beat the government with, it's just undermining pretty much everything that everyone in the entire world had been talking about in the past month, which was entirely focused on the environment, climate change, COP26, what are other countries doing? We're routinely told to look at our European neighbours and what they do, and we often come up short. And then when things like this we don't seem capable of sorting something like this for years and years and years, it undermines confidence that this kind of thing can be done. So folk just think, ah, well, forget it. And then recycling becomes just another thing that, you know, doesn't really go forward in the way that quite clearly we need to sort out.
And Rachel, it does seem to be a bit of a coincidence it was announced the week after COP26 rather than the week before COP26. Do you think that is just a coincidence, or do you think that's been done deliberately to try and keep the Scottish Government's green standards up to a very low level as we went into that event?
You can't help but wonder that, can you? Because, I mean, the Scottish Government, depending on how you look at it, did quite well at COP26. They were very much visible at the conference. And this would have been pretty bad for them had it been announced the week before COP. So you can't help but wonder if that maybe has been a deliberate move to announce it straight after the conference instead.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this, like every other subject that I feel like I've been talking about for the last 2 years, for some time to come, or at least until our bottles we get paid for when we return them to the shops, which all in all sounds like a fairly decent idea. Now, this week has seen the instruction from the Cabinet Secretary, Shona Robinson, into a bill which would eliminate or make illegal conversion therapy in Scotland. Rachel, you've been covering this subject for us this week. Can you talk us a bit through about what conversion therapy actually is and how the Scottish Government can go about banning it?
Basically, conversion therapy is any intervention which aims to change or suppress a person's sexual orientation or their gender identity. Probably the best known case that people might know about is Alan Turing. He's the World War II Enigma codebreaker. When he was found guilty of homosexuality, part of that was to give him hormone injections to suppress his sex drive. He ended up actually taking his own life 2 years after that happened. So that's probably the case that most people will be familiar with. But there aren't actually any laws specifically preventing conversion therapy in Scotland. I mean, some of the more extreme cases that involve violence and rape, they are, of course, illegal already. But the general term of conversion therapy is not actually illegal in Scotland. So this group called End Conversion Therapy Scotland, they've put a petition to the government asking for it to be introduced. In the past few weeks, MSPs have been hearing from people who have gone through conversion therapy. And as you said, we've now got this announcement from Shona Robinson that it will be banned by the end of 2023. But I think one of the questions now is what actually is going to be covered by the ban? What will it actually entail? Earlier this week, for example, we heard from a group of religious leaders in Holyrood. They are concerned that a ban would limit religious freedom, and some were even worried that it would criminalise praying. and also concerns about the right of parents to bring up their children the way they want. The argument on the other side there is the UN Special Rapporteur for Religion. He said that there's absolutely no conflict between religion and banning conversion therapy. And Pink Saltire, they're an LGBT charity which are based in Fife. They say that parents should not be allowed to sort of put their children through conversion therapy just because it's within their beliefs. I think as well this week we've seen a bit of controversy over how this all fits into the ongoing debate about trans rights at the moment. Earlier this week, Joanna Cherry, MP, she tweeted to say that she's concerned about a ban covering trans people. Her worry was gay people being convinced into believing they are trans when they are not. This has obviously caused quite an outcry from those who want to see a ban introduced, particularly because there was a LGBT survey done by the UK government in 2018, and that found that trans people are actually twice as likely to be offered or to undergo conversion therapy compared to lesbian, gay and bisexual people. So that's one of the reasons that this group are really keen to make sure that trans people are specifically covered by legislation. And they say if it's not covered, you can't call it a complete ban on conversion therapy.
So do we know, just to touch back on what Joanna Cherry tweeted, do we know if she has any evidence if that is the case, that the people that are identifying as trans are sort of being misidentified as trans when they are actually maybe gay or lesbian? Or is this some sort of conspiracy theory that Joanna Cherry is throwing out there?
Her specific tweet didn't mention anyone in particular, so I wouldn't actually know if she does have a specific example or not. But basically, the group who are wanting to push this through are very much saying this is not the case. We need to make sure that trans people are specifically covered by any legislation here.
I think part of the problem with that is that she was talking about gender dysphoria and that being something which people might seek therapy and treatment for, but the gender dysphoria is often linked to people who are maybe trans and are just not sure about what's going on. They're unfamiliar with what they're feeling at the moment. So there's this big, huge debate about, well, where does one start, where does the other end? What is gender dysphoria? What is identity? What is sexuality? And then when these all get conflated into a political row involving Joanna Cherry and different parts of the SNP and all kinds of different campaign groups, then it always just seems to turn into a row about factions rather than trying to sort of speak. The fact that we weren't really able to identify any evidence there behind what Joanna Cherry was saying or what other people were saying about Joanna Cherry kind of said it all, really. So, I mean, I would hope that for everyone's sake in this one, that they were able to sort of have a bit more of a frank conversation without it becoming yet another bit of ammunition in the fight between them.
That has been a thing that's been brought up previously by mental health professionals and psychologists. They also want to make sure that any legislation doesn't prevent them from giving therapy that doesn't constitute conversion therapy to those who have gender dysphoria and have those kind of questions. So that has been something that's been discussed as well here.
Because we do know there's maybe not been a split in the middle, but there certainly has been a tear in the SNP and the nationalist movement, which has led to some joining Alex Salmond's ALAPA party, isn't there, Andy?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them gave their reasons was disagreement over the Gender Recognition Act, and amazingly have found themselves allying with people they would maybe consider right of their political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting the way, purely objectively speaking, of course, that it's been turned into such a political football, for want of a better phrase, and the quagmire that results from it getting tossed about. And I think at the heart of it is the people that are facing conversion therapy seem to have been almost forgotten about.
Yeah, and that's always the danger here. And there's a lot going on under the surface with the political row when it comes down to Joanna Cherry in the SNP and other people. I mean, Kirsty Blackman in the SNP. They're two MPs who effectively sit on the same benches, but they have the most almighty falling outs online about issues which have their roots in these kind of equality debates in its broadest possible term. And suddenly you find yourself looking at factions, and it's all because of whether they think Nicola Sturgeon is adventurous enough with independence, and suddenly you're down all kinds of rabbit holes at that point. And again, you're the furthest thing from that discussion is actually equality, conversion therapy, and the actual subject matter at hand.
It's a very interesting subject. If you're listening and you have an experience of conversion therapy, please do get in touch if you feel that you would like to share your experience of it, because it's something that we'd like to explore more at the Sushi and, of course, with our politics team. Now, it seems to be a story that rumbles on eterno in Westminster as we entered yet another week of discussing Conservative sleaze, alleged corruption, and the need for MPs to have a second job. Scottish Conservative leader Douglas Ross found himself in a bit of hot water earlier this week after it appeared that he forgot to register his MSP's salary. And it's not the only thing he's forgot to seem to do. It would appear also that he has not registered as an in general interest at Holyrood the fact that he is employed by the SFA as a linesman or assistant referee. Andy, talk us through about why it's important MSPs register any sort of interest that could come up as a conflict when they're voting on things at Holyrood, and why it's important that they get that out in the open in the first place.
Yeah, this goes right back to the piece you identified there about the registering income at Westminster. He had to put his hands up and admit that that was a mistake. He'd put some of the refereeing money that he'd banked, but he'd not put a good few from the latter end, close to the around about Christmas time. He of course then got elected to the Scottish Parliament this May, and you know, obviously all MSPs have to go through the same sort of process, registering any income, second jobs, that kind of thing, and also any potential conflict of interest. So he did not earn the money from being a referee while he was an MSP, but so along that metric, you know, why should he? But the other political parties in Holyrood point to the wording of the rules, which suggests that members have to declare any money earned before they were elected if it could be seen to give the appearance of prejudice. Now, that there's an ambiguity about that kind of framing, because, of course, you then have to go into the discussion about, well, is there any prejudice? And it's not sure whether or not the Parliament needs to tighten up the way it sets out these rules, because if some people feel that they're being advised, well, this is no problem, fine. If some people then think this is a problem, how do you then objectively sort that out? This probably wouldn't have been an issue had it not been for the almighty scandal engulfing Westminster and the fact that Douglas Ross has been making headlines for quite a while about his split role. I mean, he's an MP and MSP, and that is by no means something that is confined to him or his party. Other parties have done exactly the same thing. It's becoming more of an issue, though, in time, and someone now being elected as an MSP who's the leader of a political party, an MP, an MSP, and has a fairly high-profile other job. He's actually out injured at the moment, so he's not earning anything at the moment from this, but he's still on the books. But all these things coming together at a time where Westminster and Boris Johnson are up to their eyeballs in it, and the fact that it's all in the same party that we're talking about here, it's just not good looking. It's no wonder that the SNP, Labour, the Greens, they're all, you know, raising a flag about this and saying that something's got to change.
And you touched upon a point there as well, where, you know, this isn't Douglas Ross isn't the first person to hold the dual roles of MP and MSP. I mean, Alex Salmond famously had it.
Yeah.
And he was also leader of the party as well, if not the leader of the group at Westminster. And then in Labour as well, it was common. Former leader Henry McLeish, he had the dual mandate right back when the Holyrood first, or when the Scottish executive at the time came into being. How, like, going forward, how likely do you think it is that MPs and MSPs will be able to share a job with each other? Or do you think this is going to be one of the outcomes on this clampdown that seems to be coming for second jobs and our elected representatives?
The second jobs row is in danger of being slightly conflated with the bigger issue, which is how are those second jobs influencing the political job? And then we come down into the proper murky world of lobbying and where money is being accepted, you know, for either implied or overt, you know, attempts to sway policy or anything like that. I mean, that is clearly a problem that needs to be fixed. Some people, I mean, a lot of people, it's hard to know exactly what the mood is on this one. They like politicians to have a previous life or even something else that makes them plugged into the kind of society that everyone sometimes feels that politicians are remote from. I would suggest there's a lot of people that quite like the fact that Douglas Ross, goes down and runs the line at the football sometimes. But for every one of those people, there's someone else saying, yeah, but that meant that he was travelling and he missed a vote, or he's not thinking about his constituents or something like that. And the same goes across other parties, where in the SNP in particular, a lot of them were councillors when they were elected. There's a lot of dual mandates for council and Holyrood and then Westminster too. To go back to your original point there, though, whether or not it just becomes politically impossible for someone to do that is probably more likely. I don't think the public really like it anymore. I don't think that something that was fairly commonplace at Holyrood to have two jobs, I think the Scottish Parliament over time has grown so much since, 1999, where, we didn't really know what the Parliament was and you could be an MSP. People even talked about two-tier MSPs, with the regional and the constituency. That doesn't happen anymore, really. I think that it's politically harder to do this dual mandate and not face a lot of scrutiny over it. So that's probably where the pressure comes from, more than changing rules.
And Rachel, Andy touched upon public trust and how the public feel about MPs and the second jobs and the influence that they may have from these in terms of lobbying. Looking back on how the reaction has been to all this over the last month or so, do you think public trust really has been rocked enough to see any permanent changes, or come the general election 24, 25, will this be something that we've all forgotten about?
That is an important point, because right now I think everybody knows about it, everyone's read about it in the papers and seen it on television, so everyone's very much... Well, not everybody, but I think a lot of people are very much thinking about what this actually means. But like you said, it's a long time now till the next election. So there is a chance that it will just be forgotten about by the next election. So many things happen over week to week, never mind year to year in politics. So there is that that thing. I think one of the things as well is that it's how do we view it? Are people potentially viewing it more as like a hobby as opposed to their full-time job if they've got all these other commitments they need to do as well? So I suppose maybe people are also considering how dedicated are they to their job of representing people if they're out doing other things and have other commitments as well. But like you said, there are people who are potentially nurses and doctors outside of politics, and I think people would be quite pleased to know that they are doing something that sort of gives them more of an insight to how things are actually working on the ground.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with that. Now, there's a phrase that's quite common in Scottish journalism anyway, that when there's a Westminster story, you always look for an angle to put a kilt on it. And I would like to thank Douglas Ross for giving the Scottish press and us the ability to put a kilt on this Westminster sleaze story. So without further ado, this week's Stoosh of the Week goes to none other than Douglas Ross.
Stoosh of the Week.
That's about all we have time for this week. Thank you to Andy, Rachel, producer Marvin, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, and even after, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe, or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.